Something's American in Denmark today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Rufus Gifford is the U.S. ambassador to Denmark, and he has no illusions about the challenges he faces.
I represent the most establishment entity that you could possibly get, which is the United States government, right? Those, in some ways, the least sexy bureaucracy in the world.
So Gifford went out and got his own show on Danish TV. More on that coming up. Plus, the late Shimon Peres was an organ donor, but most Israelis are not because of Jewish law. This man says the people making the rules are being hypocritical.
They had tattoos, which is forbidden by the Bible. They were eating cheeseburgers, which is forbidden by the Bible. But yet when it came to donating organs, all of a sudden they said that no, they couldn't donate organs because it contradicted Jewish law.
Those stories and more today on The World. Glad you could be with us on this Friday. So, hard power versus soft power. Often on the show, as we cover the news, we talk about war and the military and even nuclear weapons, all things that have to do with the idea of hard power. Today, I want to start the show on the opposite note, talking with someone who's clearly very good at using soft power. Rufus Gifford, the U.S. ambassador to Denmark. He's not what most people would think of as the typical diplomat, you know, boring ceremonies and stiff speeches. No, Ambassador Gifford has his own popular TV reality show in Denmark. He calls it a documentary series, but it is called I Am the Ambassador from America, and the cameras follow him around doing what he does as ambassador. As of this month, it's also on Netflix, so we can watch it too. I asked Ambassador Gifford how he came up with the idea for the show.
When I first took the job, I was traveling around the country and really wanted to get a sense of how the U.S. Embassy in Copenhagen really fit into the culture in Denmark. One of the things I was really struck by was the fact that Danes really had not a clue what we did. There was sort of a fascination with what we did, but there was this perception that we would play golf during the day and go to cocktail parties at night and in between, you know, go into the embassy and do, we're up to nefarious things somehow. And it just felt so wrong to me. So I felt like we were spending far too much time talking to the same people who are going to listen anyway. And what I really wanted to do is expand the audience and take our message to a broader audience, a younger audience, a more diverse audience. And how do you do that? You know, you have to get outside of your box. You have to get outside from behind your desk and go to them. So, you know, the show is an attempt to do that.
Sounds like it was originally an informational kind of show. Did it become entertainment as well?
Well, I think, you know, when you're working with a TV station, they want it to be more personal. They want it to be more salacious, of course. But you also have to make sure that there's a point to it. And certainly my bosses, and myself included, want to make sure that there is a substance to it. We need to be telling an American story and a diplomatic story. And I think the show does.
Yeah, that strikes me at some point you have to pick the telephone in Copenhagen and call Washington and ask the State Department, hey, is it okay if I have a reality show? I mean, you've got to run it up the flagpole. What did they say?
Well, first of all, we call it a documentary series, not a reality show. to distinguish ourselves as much as we can from Real Housewives and Kardashians. But it's the funny part of this story is actually we did not officially ask for permission. So the reason why, and this whole thing has taken us by enormous surprise. When we first agreed to this, ultimately, this was a small network that approached us that was appealing to younger people in Denmark. And I thought a few thousand people would watch it. You know, Denmark is a country of 5.7 million people, and it caught fire. I had not a clue, and nor did I have a say as to whether or not they would sell it to Netflix. And now it's airing all over the English-speaking world, and it is quite remarkable. And I think we probably, considering all that, probably should have asked for permission.
One Danish MP called you a rock star. You agree with that?
No. I hate the term celebrity. I hate the term rock star. I throw all of myself into my work, and I believe in this work. I love this work.
Why is this work so important to you, and why is it important to get this out on this kind of medium to a lot of people?
So, I mean, you look at our politics today. What we're seeing in the United States right now, we're seeing all throughout Europe as well. Brexit being, of course, the best example of that. But we see it in Denmark, where anti-establishment political parties, more isolationist, xenophobic, protectionist political parties are gaining strength. And the establishment is clearly losing influence. Now, I represent the most establishment entity that you could possibly get, which is the United States government, right? Those, in some ways, the least sexy bureaucracy in the world. But somehow, I wanted to try to figure out a way to humanize the U.S. government, the United States, who we are, create a sort of slightly more nuanced definition of what it means to be American. Mm-hmm. When I go to what they call gymnasiums, which are high schools all over Denmark, the questions you get are profound. This was part of the show as well. What I learned when you go to these places is that American policy, and not just American foreign policy, but American domestic policy, you know, so gun violence, race relations, and certainly surveillance and all of the issues surrounding that, were being discussed in every classroom and truly every dining room table. And I think it's important as, again, the representative of America to actually insert into that debate and have a meaningful conversation where at times you don't throw out talking points. You keep the essence of the talking point. Mm. I'm never going to contradict my president, who I have proudly worked for nearly 10 years now. But you need to add a human element to this work. And so everything we've tried to do is to try to inject a bit of humanity into this kind of unsexy world of government and try to bring us all a little bit closer. And I do think that is how you fight, in part, these anti-establishment populist waves that we're seeing take over a lot of the West.
I'm really curious to know how you've been trying to explain the Donald Trump factor, the man who kind of pioneered the reality show. Are you taking this on? Or people must be asking you about Donald Trump.
Everywhere you go. Everywhere you go. I think it's certainly front and center. So what I try to do with Danes is explain, again, sort of the nuance of the United States and bring it home to them and try to get them to understand that the same sorts of political movements that are happening here that are fueling the rise of Trump are happening there as well. And we're kind of all in this
populist
together.
Movements, these ground
these,
up.
Exactly. Yeah. These anti-establishment populist movements. It's a conversation because it actually has to be two ways to be effective. Is about trying to build bridges somehow with other cultures. And I think that's the essence of diplomacy, ultimately.
So you were a political appointee, right? You raised a ton of money for President Obama.
I am. That is correct.
And in recompense, he appoints you ambassador to Denmark. Ambassador Gifford, you are also openly gay. About a year ago, you married your husband, Stephen DeVincent, at Copenhagen City Hall. And it makes me wonder whether Denmark is one of the few countries where you could be this transparent.
Of course. I mean, if there are certain countries in the world where you certainly couldn't do the kinds of things that we did. You know, and let's be clear, I still get criticized from time to time, certainly, about being as open as I am about my sexuality, even in Denmark.
By the Danes?
By the Danes. Mm. Oh, yeah. It's a society that values privacy.
Right.
So being so open about your personal life is one of those things that's a bit controversial. But every time you get a Facebook message from a young gay kid who lives in a rural area in Denmark, who our openness gave him or her a little bit more strength to come out to their parents or something, it still matters. This level of openness still matters. And even though, yes, Denmark is progressive, first country in the world to legalize same-sex civil unions, in essence, in 1989,
yeah.
This kind of conversation is still relevant. And because, you know, the fight for equality is never over. So you have to continue to fight for it.
So Netflix is picking up your series. How do you hope Americans are going to react to the show?
I hope they learn a little bit about what it means to be an ambassador, a diplomat, a public servant, learn a little bit about Denmark, which has been so wonderful to us, and smile and laugh a little. It's not, you won't be sitting on the edge of your seat. There's no cliffhangers. There's no tremendous drama. No, it's not. And it's the agony and the tears from time to time, the exhaustion of the work, taking you to places like Greenland, which is, I've been seven times, which is an amazing, amazing corner of the world, discussing issues like climate change and ISIL and all the really, and trade and all of the big issues that we work on, in particular in Europe. I hope they learn a little bit, but also just have fun in the process. That's always what we try to do.
The Honorable Rufus Gifford, U.S. Ambassador to Denmark. Thank you very much for coming in.
It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
I've got friends from West Africa who now live in the States, and when they first arrived, they had to come up with all kinds of substitutes for the cooking ingredients they were used to back home. They'd substitute spinach for a leafy green known as boma. They'd have to abandon the rich red palm oil for peanut oil or the neutral canola oil. Ginger seemed to lend everything a certain African tinge, but generally, the authenticity just wasn't there. This is also Menkir Tamrat's story. He first came to the U.S. 30 years ago and missed the flavors from his home, Ethiopia. Solution? He started his own specialty Ethiopian chili pepper farm in the Bay Area. Reporter Meredith Hodenot of station KALW went to visit the farm.
At the edge of his farm, Menkir Tamrat walks over to a pepper plant and pulls back the dark green leaves to reveal dozens of shiny red peppers.
It looks like we have a whole bunch of ripe ones, red ones, ready to be plucked. Okay.
Over the next few weeks, Menker will harvest the long rows of peppers. Then he'll dry them, crush them, and make them into spice blends essential to Ethiopian cuisine.
The chili first, and then 12 or 11 plus additions of seasonings and spices and herbs. The balance of heat and color, it's a sum of all these different things.
Menker wasn't always a farmer. He grew up in the countryside of Ethiopia in the 60s. He watched farmers working in the fields and selling their vegetables at the market.
Who did the cooking at home?
Well, that was my mother's, or whoever helped her. I don't think my father set foot in the kitchen.
Then, in the early 80s, Menker came to the Bay Area, got his MBA, and started a career in high-tech management. The food from his homeland was never far from his heart. But when he tried to recreate it with local California ingredients, something was missing.
Because I couldn't create the chili powder from off-the-shelf chilies. You know, it's a hit and miss. How do you know which one might be the closest?
So Menker went home to Ethiopia and brought back the seeds he needed to start a garden. He filled his yard with herbs and vegetables and peppers, the fresh flavors that made all the difference. As we walk through the farm, Menker shows me a dried leaf. It smells a bit like citrusy oregano.
This leaf called kosaret, you can't never find it. It's not used in any other cuisine. And it's got its own strong, unusual taste, smell.
Oh, yeah.
For decades, Menker's garden was just a passion project. But when his tech company downsized in 2009, Menker took the opportunity to grow these Ethiopian flavors on a larger scale. He connected with a local farm, and by that summer, he had 5,000 pepper plants, taking root in California soil. Once Menker had a steady supply of the peppers, he pored over books and articles and recipes, searching for the perfect spice blend. But when he started mixing flavors together, he realized he was missing a major secret ingredient, the mom touch.
In Ethiopian cuisine, is like, you know, so-and-so's mom is known for her such and such, and she may have like one little secret thing that she adds in it. So you never get the same thing, you know, from two families making the same stew.
So for help, he turned to a friend of his mother's who lived in Oakland, and he'd follow his mother-in-law around the kitchen with a notebook when she visited from Ethiopia. And he finally came up with a spice blend that was worthy of home.
I even took some samples to a restaurant in Ethiopia just to show off and said, why don't you guys taste this? And the lady just could not believe it that I brought this from America and a man made it.
Menker sells his spices to restaurants in the Bay Area through his company, Timeless Harvest. But this season, he split his time between California and Ethiopia, where he's diving into an exciting new project. He started a farm back home to grow Western crops like Swiss chard and Tuscan kale, vegetables that are extremely hard to find in Ethiopia. The capital is headquarters for many international political organizations, and Menker hopes to tap into a blossoming market of high-end Western restaurants that sprung up there over the last decade.
Seems like you're being drawn more and more back to Ethiopia.
I am fortunate enough that I can say I have two countries, and I don't have to choose one over the other. Different opportunities are provided by the two different places. I think more people should have two countries, more than once, anyway.
For The World, Meredith Hodnott in Sanol, California.
You're listening to The World. Cyclists in London got some good news today. The city is planning to ban the most dangerous lorries from the streets. Lorries, that's what the Brits call big transport trucks like semis. And lorries are also the highest cause of cycling deaths in the city. That's why London Mayor Sadiq Khan decided some of them had to go. The World's Man in London, Leo Hornack, has some thoughts about this. We reached him at a cycling cafe in London called Look Mum, No Hands.
Well, I mean, I'm a cyclist myself. I cycle into work and I've done for many years, and I'm a bit of a cycling evangelist. So I don't know if this interview will adhere to the normal standards of BBC, immaculate neutrality and impartiality, but I will try and raise above those biases to say that I think it's pretty great news, and a lot of people at cafes like this are pretty excited. I've been chatting to the other customers and the people working here, and, you know, this kind of news gets a pretty good thumbs up, as you would expect. Anything which is going to make life safer for cyclists in this city obviously is going to please cyclists. But that's the headline. It's when you start to dig into the details, actually, it's, as so often, a little bit more complicated, Marco.
Yeah, so what did you find upon closer inspection of this law?
Well, it's only certain lorries, and it's only the most dangerous, I should say, and this ban is only going to come into effect in 2020, so another 4 years from now, or three and a bit years. And not to be too kind of gory about this, but cyclists do die every year. The lorries that are going to be banned, or the semis, as you would say, that are going to be banned, are the ones which are rated as having the very worst visibility. That means the driver is up in a kind of cab. It's the kind of long-haul vehicle that you would expect on a kind of, you know, transcontinental freeway or something. But these are the kind of vehicles that do get crammed into these very twisty, twiny kind of London streets. And it's very difficult for those drivers to see someone on two wheels right underneath them, to the side or to the back or even in front. And as a result, I had a look at some of the stats, and 79% of cyclist deaths in the last 3 years have involved vehicles like this that are going to be banned. That was the last 3 years. We're going to have these vehicles on the road for another 3 years until 2020. So there's the questions that people are asking here, particularly in the kind of those who are in the cycling community.
One question I have, Leo, this is a good move for cyclists eventually, but what about provisioning restaurants and shops in the center of the city? How's this going to impact commerce?
Well, exactly. I mean, it's great for the cyclist to cheer when you hear that certain kinds of vehicles are banned. And yeah, it's great because it may well save lives. But you can't, as you were just implying, You can't really fit out, a large luxury hotel or a restaurant with supplies on the back of two wheels. These kind of major cities require large quantities of goods to be moved around, and we don't really have a solution to that yet. At the moment, the solution is to try and make these vehicles safer in incremental ways, increase the visibility, make it so that someone driving can see the traffic around them more clearly, lower the cabs. These are small tweaks, but they don't solve that fundamental problem that we need these trucks, and to some extent in the city, but we also don't need the danger that they can bring.
Yeah, so ultimately, what does this lorry ban mean?
Well, it means that we will wait another 3 years for cycle safety to change drastically. But in 2020, things will begin to look a little bit different.
Will you still be commuting to work in 2020?
Well, I mean, Marco, I don't know if you're offering me some kind of chauffeur-driven opportunity here, but if so, I accept.
Our man in London, Leo Hornack, thanks very much.
Thanks very much, Marco. I'm going to get on my bike and head back to the office right now.
From the streets of London to the streets of New York now, or at least I think it's the streets of New York I'm seeing in a new video from the Colombian band Bomba Estéreo. It's for the song Soy Yo, and it's really good. Soy yo. We featured Bomba Estéreo on The World before, but the video to Soy Yo gives a fresh perspective to the trio. I spoke with Natalia Linares about this. She's a publicist and Latina cultural advocate. And this is what Soy Yo means to her.
That's me. It's a very affirmative, strong statement. Like, I am what I am.
So what's going on in the video? What's the action?
We have this young girl. She could be from anywhere. She's an immigrant, clearly, in New York City, it appears. And she's just fierce. She's just taking control, showing who she is, unapologetic, creative.
She's got these pigtails, and she's like taking on these three guys like it's 3-on-1 on a basketball court.
Yes, I love her. I love her. She's me. You know, when I saw this, I was like, this is what I was doing 20 years ago in New York City. Although I wish I was taking upon my challenges in that kind of creative way.
Right.
So I think it's super powerful and strong.
What do you think shifted over time? I mean, I know this is a band from Colombia, but, you know, I gather this song has resonated with a lot of young Latinas.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think shifted in that time that, you know, videos, images, visuals like this are now appearing?
I think it was a lot of groundwork that's being done because we're in the digital internet age and we have been able to find each other and take strength in each other and in ourselves. I mean, Bomba Estéreo, yes, they're from Colombia, but they spend time in the U.S., you know, they spend a lot of time in New York, traveling, touring. So you can't help but be influenced by what you're seeing, whether that's hip hop culture, which you're seeing in the video. She's literally doing the Cabbage Patch.
And really kind of blowing everybody away.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a popular GIF now. It's going around in my circles. I'm also seeing families all over the U.S. sharing this, which I think is really important that we're seeing these kind of representations of Latinas as everyday people. And just weaving into the fabric of the United States.
So the people this girl meets in the street on the video, they kind of look on her with disdain, but then she has this confidence to just, you know, do her own thing despite the stares. She's just herself. I mean, that's the title of the song.
Mm-hmm.
That was that trope with that series, Ugly Betty. Is this a common narrative for young Latinas, you know, kind of ignore the haters and just pump yourself up with confidence?
I think we have to look within to find the strength with, you know, some of the invisibility that happens.
It's not easy.
It isn't. But it also, we do have a lot of pride and we do feel a lot of strength from the stories of our families and of what they've had to do to come to this country. And so, you know, I think that is where we're going.
What about your own story, Natalia? I mean, looking at some of these moments in the video, did it take you back to your own childhood and kind of encounters and challenges you had?
Oh, yeah. The nerdy glasses took me there instantly.
But how did you overcome the nerdiness?
How did I overcome the nerdiness?
Because you're one of the most confident people I know in this business right now.
You know, I look to my parents and I know that I have a lot to do based off their sacrifice. And that gives me the strength.
So just to get a little more personal, what was your parents' sacrifices for you?
Oh, wow. Well, you know, my mom came from Cuba at age 14. My father from Colombia. My dad was a taxi driver for 12 years in New York City. And just that work ethic. My father held two jobs for a long time, left at 6 in the morning, came home at 12 at night. I think there's that universal story that a lot of us feel.
Natalia Linares, thanks very much for giving us your take on Soy Yo. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Marco.
Natalia Linares is a publicist and a Latina cultural advocate based in Northampton, Massachusetts. You can catch the video to Bomba Estéreo song, Soy Yo, on our Facebook page. Just look for The World. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, comedian Zahra Nurbakhsh. She's married, she's Muslim, and this summer on her popular podcast, she came out as bisexual.
I was terrified of the politics of it, of whether it was appropriate. And then also, of course, my parents listened to the podcast.
Stick around and find out what happened next here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Shimon Peres was buried today. But even after his passing, he had a way to keep giving to others. That's a story we're going to hear in just a moment. This was the burial ceremony earlier today in Jerusalem. The former Israeli president and prime minister, you'll recall, died on Wednesday at the age of 93. Shimon Peres had been a fixture of Israeli public life since the Jewish state was created in 1948. And today, leaders and dignitaries from all over the globe gathered to pay their last respects, among them President Obama.
Shimon accomplished enough things in his life for 1,000 men. But he understood that it is better to live to the very end of his time on earth with a longing not for the past, but for the dreams that have not yet come true. An Israel that is secure in a just and lasting peace with its neighbors.
A few years before he died, Peres did something that very few Israeli Jews do. He signed up to be an organ donor. It's something he strongly believed in, and when he died this week, his corneas were donated. Daniela Cheslow has our story.
When he was Israel's president in 2012, Shimon Peres gathered families of organ donors at his residence in Jerusalem and pulled out a green plastic card. It was from the National Transplant Center.
definition of time.
Peres said he'd signed up 2 years earlier to be an organ donor, and he called on all Israelis to sign up too. But only about 15% of Israelis have done it. That's compared to about 45% of Americans who have organ donor cards. This drives Robbie Berman crazy, especially since many Israelis are secular Jews who don't follow religious rules.
They had tattoos, which is forbidden by the Bible. They were eating cheeseburgers, which is forbidden by the Bible. But yet when it came to donating organs, all of a sudden they became holier than thou, and they said that no, they couldn't donate organs because it contradicted Jewish law.
Robbie is an Israeli-American who runs the Halachic Organ Donor Society in Jerusalem. That first word, halachic, refers to Jewish law based on the Talmud. And that's Robbie's strategy, to convince Jews in Israel and abroad that Judaism allows donating your organs. Here's what he's up against. First, what is death?
There are rabbis who believe that when a person's brain is dead, even though the organism has died and the heart is pumping only as a result of the person's body being connected to a ventilator, they believe the person is alive. The chief rabbinate of Israel ruled 20 years ago that brain death is death and people should donate organs. But the masses are unaware of that.
There are also laws in the Bible.
You're not allowed to desecrate a dead body or mutilate a dead body. You're not allowed to delay burial of a dead body. And you're not allowed to get benefit from a dead body. So you couldn't sell a dead body to a medical school and get money from it. But everyone agrees, all rabbis agree, that if you can save a life, you're supposed to override just about every single biblical commandment.
Another challenge. Some religious Jews believe they'll need their organs when they're resurrected. How could Shimon Peres donating his corneas compete with that?
That's not going to change my mind. If I believe I need my organs for resurrection of the dead, so fine, Shimon Peres was an idiot. He'll be resurrected from the dead, but he'll be blind. That's what they're thinking. He'll be blind.
I tell Robbie, I'm surprised by his pessimism. So he sets out to prove his point. We stop some passers-by in Jerusalem. Ilan Marmor is leaving a bank where he's a manager.
Do you have an organ donor card here in Israel?
No. I don't have.
Okay, how long have you been living here?
Already 35 years.
And may I ask you why you don't have an organ donor card?
I don't know, really. The society needs people to donate. Right. But also people didn't ask me, so...
We stop a young woman who says her name is Liat. She says she's religious, so she's not really interested in the issue.
As a Rav Amar, Rav Avad Yosef,
Rabbi starts listing rabbis who support organ donations. Chief Rabbi Shlomo Amar, the late Chief Rabbis Ovadia Yosef and Mordechai Eliyahu. Maybe I'll sign up, Liat concedes. Organ donation in Israel has gone up since Rabbi started his group. 15 years ago, only 3% of Israelis had a donor card. As for Palestinians, they don't have an organ donor program, according to a spokesman for the Palestinian Ministry of Health, but they're working on it. Earlier this year, the former chief of Israel's intelligence agency, Meir Dagan, died and donated his corneas. An elderly blind man received one of them, which restored his vision. Outside a bar, I find Emmanuel Saunders, a 29-year-old artist, who has a donor card. He says he got it a few years ago. It seemed like a small way to possibly save a life. And he thinks about what it might be like for the person who gets the corneas from Shimon Peres, who was celebrated for his sunny outlook.
To receive optimistic eyes, I don't think it's a bad thing.
For The World, Daniela Cheslow, Jerusalem.
We've heard a lot about women in different parts of the world fighting to end female genital mutilation, or FGM. But in Kenya, there's a Maasai warrior chief, a man, who's taken up the cause. For the past few years, he's been trying to persuade other men to use their power to end the practice. And he's doing so in one of the most conservative communities in Kenya. Wairimu Gitahi reports.
Dressed in a colorful red, blue, and white cloth, wrapped around his waist and over his shoulder, with necklaces made of white beads across his chest, typical Maasai attire of men his age, 28-year-old Olelein Kanunga sings and dances with his fellow Maasai warriors. He's carrying a long dark brown stick, which symbolizes he is their leader. If this all sounds very traditional, it is. But Olelein is also a revolutionary. He wants to end the practice of female genital mutilation, or FGM, among the Maasai. A few years ago, he attended a workshop about health issues that changed his life.
Sababu wakati tulikuwa na hiyo program,
At the workshop,
we heard about a girl who'd gone through female genital mutilation and almost died because she'd lost so much blood. It made me think, what if that was my daughter? That's when I decided I wouldn't let my daughters go through FGM. I also decided I'd start a campaign to help my community put a stop to it.
The workshop was run by an NGO called AMREF. Peter Ngura is in charge of the group's campaign to end FGM.
It's a severe and gross human rights abuse. It comes with severe health effects, the severe bleeding. We have infertility coming as a result. We have birth complications. And the other part is the economic, because the women are denied positions. They are denied educational opportunities because immediately after female genital mutilation, girls are treated as mature and they are married off at 10 years, at 15 years, so they never complete school, so they are not economically empowered. It's a terrible, terrible evil in the 21st century. It should have ended.
And ending FGM is what Olelein is striving to do in his conservative Maasai community. He gives talks like this one under a tree, where he invites young Maasai men to discuss the dangers of FGM. Olelein receives funding and training mainly from AMREF, the NGO fighting FGM. The idea is to use his position as a Maasai warrior leader in charge of 750 young men in his community to influence change.
These young men are of marrying age, so it's important to educate them on the benefits of marrying a girl who's not gone through FGM. They're also the ones who make decisions about what happens to their family, so they're key in fighting against this practice. They're among the main decision makers in our community.
Olelein's campaign among his peers is slowly starting to bear fruit. This is his friend James Leyan, lamenting that his own wife had to go through this ritual.
Baba yangu, ndiye ameniambia nataka twende boma fulani.
When it was time for me to get a wife, I told my father that I didn't want my wife to go through FGM. He was furious and said that I was going against tradition. I ran away from home for 2 weeks, hoping my father would change his mind, but he didn't. I got desperate and went back home and had to accept my father's wishes. So my wife has gone through FGM. I wish this was not the case, but I will make sure my daughter does not go through it.
Today, Olelein is visiting the homestead of another Maasai warrior, Jeremiah Ormoi. During such visits, he gets a chance to talk to families about the dangers of FGM. He also gets a chance to interact with other visitors who might be around. Oletianda is one of the visitors here. Even though he's 27 years old, he's as adamant as some of the elders who believe that FGM should not be done away with.
This act is a part of our culture, and we should not do away with it. I have been to workshops about fighting this practice, but I still feel it should go on because it's a part of our culture.
Many people in this community still think this way. Olelein also has to deal with the fact that he's a man campaigning against an issue seen widely as a women's only affair. But he says he won't give up.
Some people say to me, don't you have something better to do than get involved in women's issues? They say I should be protecting our cultural practices. But I carry on because I know I am doing the right thing.
The sun is setting and the animals that were taken out to graze are returning home. Olelein is making his way home too, after a long day trying to sensitize his community against FGM. Tomorrow, he will head to a primary school nearby to continue his campaign. For the World, Wairimu Gitahi, Magadi Ward, Southern Kenya.
So here's what you don't typically hear when something crashes. Yep, those are scientists at the European Space Operations Center in Darmstadt, Germany. They're clapping because their spacecraft just crash-landed, as planned, onto a comet. The Rosetta probe had been orbiting in space for the past 2 years, sending information back to Earth. Today, its mission ended. Mark McCaffrian is a senior scientific advisor for the project.
The signal's off, and it's down. The signal's gone. we've lost Rosetta, and... What can I say? It's just a lot of emotions coming through and people hugging. So special moment for everybody here. But again, let's be proud. We've achieved something utterly extraordinary here.
Monica Grady was also part of the team that worked on the Rosetta mission. She's a professor in planetary sciences at the Open University in England, but she's in Germany now, and we have her on the line. And it was a little hard to get in touch with you, Monica, because I gather you were celebrating with a big cake in the shape of a comet?
Yes, that's right. It's a celebration. It's a wake. So, yes, there was a chocolate cake in the shape of a comet, and we've said goodbye to a dear friend who has been with us for many, many years, with whom we have special memories, we've shared special events, but they've gone now. And what should we do next is the sort of feeling. And that's what it's like with a space mission. You never stop. You build and carry on and do the next mission.
Are you able, in a few words, to explain what you learned from this mission?
In a few words, no. There were so many highlights. For me, the most stunning findings have been the images of the comet's surface. And if you imagine looking at the pebbles in the bed of a river, some of the pictures that we've got of the comet look like that. But they can't possibly have formed in a river because there are no rivers on this comet, never have been. So we have to come up with a new idea of how all these features have formed. And that's really exciting, seeing the birth of a new science.
Well, we heard the emotion in Mark McCaffrey's voice earlier. I mean, why can't the project keep getting data from Rosetta while it's zooming through space on this comet?
Ah, because Rosetta is solar powered and so didn't have enough energy to actually do anything. So it would have had to have gone into hibernation, and you'd have been waiting for the comet to come back round the sun, by which time the experiments that Rosetta could do would not be returning the sort of data that we needed. Whereas actually landing on the comet, getting those final images at a distance of 51 meters, 5 seconds before touchdown, they are invaluable. Mm. You know, we'll be looking at those for a long, long time.
So you've got those great photographs. Plus, I got to say, a crash landing is a really glorious way for things to end.
Well, let's not think of it as a crash landing. Let's think of it as a graceful touchdown.
Well, you're from the Open University in the UK, working with people in Germany, your equals across Europe. So cooperation works.
Cooperation certainly works. And that's one of the great things about the European Space Agency is it brings nations together, it brings teams together. And you can say, right, actually, we want to build this gizmo, and somebody from Germany wants to build that gizmo, and we exchange information, and we work together.
Monica Grady, who was part of the team that worked on the Rosetta mission, I hear music in the background, Monica, so I'm going to let you get back to the celebration and the cake. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks very much.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. It took me a few years to get there, but I recently read Barack Obama's memoir, Dreams from My Father. And it's a good reminder that President Obama, the man, even after nearly 8 years of policymaking and political battles, is still that guy with an interesting background. He's what we call a TCK. The host of The World's Otherhood podcast is Rupa Shenoy. And Rupa, what is a TCK?
A third culture kid. They're usually kids of missionaries or military people, or more often, more recently, kids of employees of international companies. Like Barack Obama's stepdad was working for a company in Indonesia, so that's why he grew up partly there. They spend formative years in other countries, sometimes in international American schools, and they're an unusual combination of cultures, hence third culture kid. I talked to Steph Yu at Denizen, the online magazine for third culture kids.
What, third culture kids is enough of a thing that there's a magazine?
One magazine, yeah. Actually, you're surprised that it exists. I was surprised that there's only one because there are so many third culture kids now, and they're all trying to understand this experience. So Steph was born in Hong Kong, raised in Singapore, and schooled K through 12 at an elite American high school in the Little American neighborhood of Singapore.
The streets in Singapore have Singaporean or Malay names like Bukit Timah, but the streets in like Little America have street names like Elm or Maple. And also they're mostly like single family homes, whereas most Singaporeans live in like apartment buildings or condos. every October during Halloween, it becomes a huge deal in that neighborhood. And so there would be people who would like come to Little America just to experience like trick-or-treating and Halloween. It's not too dissimilar with like how people might go to Chinatown to like experience Chinese New Year, right?
So Steph lives in Little America in Singapore. She sounds American too.
Yeah, she says she sounded like that when she was 10. And she did a lot of the things that American kids do, like she had school dances. So she knew how the U.S. worked when she went to college at Northwestern in Illinois. But she had these weird cultural knowledge gaps.
In many ways, I function, you know, as sort of an invisible immigrant, which a lot of TCKs do. They show up in college and they're an invisible immigrant. They walk around, they might look American, they sound American, and they're just expected to blend in and figure it out. But you haven't, like, watched the same TV shows as everybody or experienced the same cultural things as everybody, and they may not know that you're different, but you are, and you just kind of roll with it. You just figure it out.
So she's not complaining. Mm. Steph says the TCK upbringing can be really privileged, but people who grow up that way are a really particular blend of traditions with unique insight into the ways cultures intersect. They get to a point where they don't expect other people to understand them. Steph says her background is so confusing to people that when she's at parties and people ask her where she's from, she lies.
Why would she lie about where she's from?
Well, that was my question.
I find myself lying a lot.
Lying?
Yeah, absolutely. If someone asks me where am I from, I will dance around the truth of it because it takes so darn long to explain it. Not that I'm trying to be deceitful. It's just that it's so complicated. When I'm in Hong Kong, which is where I was born and where my family is from, I don't really fit in there. I'm Asian, so I look like I'm from Hong Kong, but I certainly don't sound like I'm from Hong Kong. I'll just be like, oh, I'm from Singapore. It's just like all these shortcuts that I take to just keep the conversation moving so that people don't dwell too hard on stuff.
Rupa, why do you think it's important that we think about President Obama as a TCK like Steph?
She describes it, and a lot of people describe it, as a super formative experience. It makes them really complex people. It taught them to be comfortable in multiple cultures. And before Obama leaves office, I find it interesting to note that the person who led the country for the last 8 years is one of these people.
Yeah, sure is. Rupa Shenoy of the Otherhood podcast, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And you can find the latest episode of Otherhood at PRI.org or on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Our next story also has to do with identity and how we talk about it. Zara Nurbakhsh came out as bisexual shortly after the shooting at Pulse Nightclub in Orlando last June. And she did it in a very public way on her podcast. It's called Hashtag Good Muslim, Bad Muslim. Zara is one of the co-hosts.
It was such a relief. And then, of course, then I was terrified. I was terrified of the politics of it, of whether it was appropriate, whether I could speak on the matter. And then also, of course, my parents listened to the podcast and I was like, what are they going to think? And do I tell them? And I just started to feel really, really sick and like bugs were crawling all up and down my body and really scared. And I was really afraid of all of their reactions.
Zara Nurbakhsh wrote about her experience for Bitch Media and sat down to talk about it with The World's Karen Peterson. Hey, Karen.
What up, Marco?
So how does this story end, Karen? Did she end up coming out to her family?
Yeah, eventually. Zara's a comedian, so she was actually touring for a couple of weeks before she was able to make it home and finally got to tell her parents in person, which is crazy because the entire time she was terrified that they were going to listen to the podcast.
Wow. How did they react?
They reacted really well, which is something that surprised her. She told me that her mom especially had this really beautiful reaction, and I kind of want to let her explain it.
My mother reminded me that nobody stands between you and Allah. Jesus walked on water, but Allah gave an illiterate young orphaned boy a book and said, read, because self-discovery makes a prophet.
I really love that reaction because it combats this really ugly stereotype that Islam stands in opposition to the LGBT community and that being Muslim is to be homophobic.
Yeah, what did Zara say when you pressed her on that whole kind of notion?
She hates it, really hates it. And she pointed out something that I guess is obvious, but needs to be said, I think, a lot more, that there are homophobic Muslims, there are homophobic Christians, there are homophobic atheists, and so on and so on.
It is really refreshing to hear something that is more of a counter-narrative to those prejudices, I gotta say.
I mean, absolutely. You hear stories all the time of people coming out as gay, but you really don't hear stories about the process of coming out as bisexual, especially she's 36 years old. This isn't the typical story of a teenager coming out. She's married and honestly could pass as straight for the rest of her life, but it was important to her to tell that story. I could go on at length about what it meant to me to read her essay as a bisexual myself, but honestly, I had this whole conversation with her, and she pretty much hit the nail on the head and said exactly what I was thinking.
I wanted to be able to share a story that showed that you can come out to your parents and they can receive you and hold you and love you unconditionally still and appreciate this new aspect of you and the work it took to discover that about yourself. That does happen. That can occur. Because I think we need to hear those stories. The emails that I've received have been so lovely. All of them are about hope and how this gives people hope that they can have these conversations.
Wow. You know, it's overcoming the fear of being honest, and that's not easy no matter what you want to say, isn't it?
For sure.
The World's Karen Peterson, thank you so much.
Thanks, Marco.
If you want to read Zara's essay, we've got an excerpt at PRI.org. In it, she talks about how her sexuality became invisible, how she came out to her husband, and how her mother's first reaction to finding out was to make a bunch of dirty jokes. And that'll do it for us this Friday. The World's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH. And on Monday, I'll be coming to you from KJZZ in Phoenix. Till then, have yourselves a great weekend.
PRI, Public Radio International.